This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
Compass Media Networks. This is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
The NFL tries to protect the franchise. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka on this Super Bowl weekend. Thanks for joining us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
And with the Super Bowl Sunday evening, a look at what the National Football League is doing to regain its buzz among fans.
Ardent supporters of President Trump can't relate to people who are surprised by his executive order on immigration. We'll explain why.
Know someone looking for a line of work? CareerCast.com is out with a list of the most in-demand jobs in America.
And the most controversial play in the NFL may soon be disappearing, and that's leaping over the line to block a kick.
The rule book says you cannot jump over a player and land on them in an attempt to block the kick, or a player can't lift up a teammate, you know, to basically push him over the line. Those two plays are illegal, but if you have the skills to take a running start, time the snap perfectly, and jump over the line, then it's a legal play.
Wall Street Journal reporter Jim Cherusmi on what the NFL will do with that play. He's here later in the hour. Well, amid the outcry over President Trump's executive action on immigration, here's an angle that has not gotten much coverage. The people who elected Mr. Trump say the furor over his executive order is nothing compared to the one he'd cause if he did nothing to crack down on travel into the country from nations linked with terrorism. Here's USA Today national correspondent Rick Hampson. Rick, what have you done with this group you call Trump Nation?
Well, we tried to, in addition to polling, we tried to establish connections with people in all 50 states last year during the campaign, before the conventions, just to sort of get a personal feel for the people who were Trump supporters, because there was a lot of arguing about who they really were and what they thought and what they needed. So we've stayed in touch with these folks. And I have to say, Gordon, despite all of what you hear about how people, especially Trump supporters, hate the media, I invariably have, you know, very civil discussions with these folks, and they're always glad to hear me call, which is good too.
Right. So you've had some strong reactions though, and I think this is the other side that we've not seen. Right. We've seen the demonstrations at airports that just gets lots of coverage, but there is this other side. You spoke to a handful of folks about this angle. Explain what some of them have been saying.
Well, let me give you an example. There's this a guy named Gene Dunn. He's from Long Island. He cares so much about Trump. He loves Trump so much that he took his son out of school when Trump declared back in June of 2015 to take him to Trump Tower to hear Trump announce. And so Gene says to me, you know, he doesn't like all the what he calls the whining about the chaos being caused by the travel ban. He says, quote, "If you want chaos, watch what happens when some ISIS maniac yells Allah Akbar and proceeds to mow down innocent Americans with a machine gun, bomb, big construction truck, or WMD." So that's what's in it. That's how he sees it. That this chaos is nothing compared to what you could have.
Is that sentiment largely reflected in a lot of these folks you've spoken to? Do they all feel that strongly about this?
They don't all feel strongly about this. For one thing, it's not clear to all of them that this would really avoid what Gene Dunn is worried about. For instance, I spoke to one guy, Mike McCoy. He owns a sawmill in outside Asheville, North Carolina, up in the Western Mountains. And he said that he doesn't really understand the ins and the outs of international travel. He says, "I never do it."
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's not one of those people who has a passport and goes to Europe once a year or anything like that. So it's a little unclear to him, but he really does wonder, you know, just from a common sense point of view, how effective it would be when you have so much, or a fair amount at least, of terrorism springing up, you know, internally,
right,
not coming from overseas.
We're speaking,
but for the most part, these people are still very personally loyal to Trump, and for the most part, they think they're for this.
We're speaking with Rick Hampson, national correspondent at USA Today. His piece is called Trump Nation Says Controversial Immigration Order is No Surprise to Them. I think it was a professor at Seton Hall University in New Jersey who said to you, Trump caught the population off guard on this with the immigration rule. People did not expect it to happen so soon. Were there expectations?
Yeah, I think Dr. Amar, who said that, I think he was sort of playing, he's a business professor at Seton Hall, but I think he was playing a bit of psychologist, arguing that he thinks that a lot of the dismay from opponents is more that of surprise than as much as anything else. That once the order is digested, he says, they won't find it to be so so objectionable. Of course, in his view, they should have known it was coming because you know Trump said it was coming.
Yes, well, that's the hard part to square for so many people. A politician delivering on campaign promises, right?
Yeah.
Very foreign.
It's always surprising.
What are the expectations beyond this point? Do you have a feel for that based on what folks from Trump Nation have said with regards to the immigration rule?
Well, I think this is certainly one of or the acid test for Trump's base. Clearly, they're with him on this. I mean, I see very little erosion except for some qualms by people like Mike McCoy, very little erosion. So Trump's base is behind him. And as he tries to move through Congress, that's really important because he doesn't need the Democrats. He needs a unified Republican Party. Mm. And he's the most popular Republican in most of the districts that these people live in, and they're why. So even though his approval rating continues to decline among the nation in general and is virtually non-existent among Democrats at this point, among his supporters, among Republicans, he is literally more popular than ever.
Thanks, Rick. Rick Hampson, USA Today national correspondent. 12 minutes now after the hour on this Super Bowl weekend. Thanks for being with us. So enjoy the Super Bowl this weekend, if you'll even be watching. Might be the last time the game is presented in its current form on TV. The Super Bowl arrives in Houston this year as the NFL searches for ways to bolster the game to tighten its grip on our attention. Wall Street Journal sports writer Matthew Futterman says the league has begun experimenting with shuffling the way ads appear in broadcasts and might tweak the pace of the sport itself. Matt, what's happening here?
Well, what you're seeing for most of the season is what you saw was a smaller number of people who were actually watching the games. The ratings were down fairly significantly across the board, and especially during the first couple months of the season when the election was going on. So the NFL is going to be tinkering with the way the game is sort of laid out, trying to maybe shorten commercial breaks, run commercials a little differently, figure out exactly how to keep people engaged and make what is a 3+ hour game a little more enjoyable.
Mm. All right, so shortening the commercial breaks with the intent of actually shortening the game?
Well, there's an intent. Well, I guess it they don't mind so much that the game is 3+ hours, but it's the flow of it that they're a little worried about. And you can shorten the commercial breaks, but they can't really decrease the number of commercials because the networks have to make their money back. So you could shorten commercial breaks, but then have more. But then you'd probably have to have more of them or try and convince the networks to move some commercials to halftime. Mm. Or what you could do is eliminate a commercial. There's usually 5 commercial breaks per quarter. You could go to 4 and just have them be a little bit long, 30 seconds longer, so you distribute the commercials. It's unclear. They tested some of this stuff over Christmas weekend to see, what worked, what didn't work, what they might be able to do with it. They haven't reached any conclusions yet, but they're pretty serious about understanding that, the world's changing, they need to change with it, and, they don't want to be knocked off the pedestal of being the most popular sports and entertainment television product,
right,
in the U.S.
What about bringing back the old spot pass? I mean, that had a little zip to the game, wouldn't it?
the spot pass. You know, I think they do want to tinker with the game. You know, some things with the game itself that might improve the flow as well. But they're not sure exactly what that is. I think that's something that the competition committee will take up at the next meeting in March.
You mentioned fan discontent in your story. What's behind that?
Well, there's a lot of things behind it. You know, there's a sense that, you know, we all fight against the great battle of time. And NFL games take up a lot of time. So there's a sense of that. Nobody likes sitting at the television. A team scores a touchdown, kicks the extra point, go to a commercial break, come back from that. The other team kicks off, go to another commercial break.
Yeah,
you're talking about 10 minutes of commercials and, you know, really essentially 2 seconds of action.
Right.
So it's kind of ridiculous. People don't like that. There was, I think people are, they understand that what they're watching in football, when they're watching football these days, that they might be watching people getting brain damage. That has turned some people off from the game. And, you know, since my piece has run, I have been contacted by a lot of fans. Say they were very turned off by, the kneeling protest in September with, you know, Colin Kaepernick.
Yeah.
That's something I haven't mentioned. I didn't mention my story. It's not really exactly measurable, but it's out there, you know, and it probably contributes to this sort of groundswell of, I would say, a loosening grip on the public public psyche from the NFL.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Matthew Futterman. He's in Houston for the Super Bowl. He's written a piece called "NFL Calls New Plays to Protect Its Lucrative Franchise." What about teams on the move like the Rams, Chargers, Raiders, possibly?
Yeah, there is an interesting level of instability for a company, an entity that is that successful to have this level of volatility, let's say. You know, especially because San Diego and Oakland say they are moving because it doesn't make sense to build a stadium in their markets, you know, that the finances can't support it. The naming rights deals, the premium seats, stuff like that, they wouldn't be able to compete successfully and pay for those very expensive stadiums.
Thanks, Matt. Wall Street Journal sports writer Matthew Futterman, who is in Houston for the Super Bowl on Sunday. It's 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. For some home buyers, there is no factor more important than the public schools their children will attend. They analyze student body performance on standardized tests, school rankings, what percentage of alumni go on to four-year colleges, and which schools send students to Ivy League or top-tier state universities. They then uproot their lives to move within these districts' boundaries. And as Wall Street Journal reporter Katie McLaughlin says, often money is no object. Katie, what'd you take a look at here?
I took a look at people who've gone to extraordinary lengths to move into great school districts. These are people who one couple picked up and moved from one city to the other to get their kids into this great school. Other people really stretched financially, or they rented houses for years to be in that school district. One couple moved from a place where I think they really felt they belonged. They're kind of artsy, hipster-type people to this very, PTA-style neighborhood, but because they felt that their kids really needed that great public school district.
Wow. Why not just say try a private school or a parochial school closer to home?
Well, for a lot of people, it's the cost. People in the New York area, they're looking at the numbers are totally amazing. I mean, $35,000, $40,000 a year in tuition. And lots of people pointed out to me, elite private schools, it doesn't stop at the tuition. There's also lots of fundraising that goes on at those schools, and there can be a lot of pressure to make additional contributions. So it just, if you have, two or three kids, you're looking at giant sums of money on private school tuition.
Yeah.
But there was something else that one of the families pointed out. They didn't want private school. I thought that was interesting. These are people with plenty of resources. I think they probably could have, you know, paid tuition pretty easily.
You know,
they didn't want it. They want that public school experience for their kids. Some people really feel that, you know, I think private school is often positioned as the greatest thing in the world. But there are a lot of people who think, no, a great public school is the greatest thing in the world.
You know, it's funny because you opened the story talking about this, the Hammett family from Houston moving to Austin, Texas, 165 miles away. And I thought, wow, that's a pretty good commitment. You know, probably just picked up a small home to live there for a couple of years. And I realized, oh, they dropped $2.25 million on that new home. I thought, that's when I thought, geez, it would have been cheaper just to find a private school in Houston. But
that actually was the family that rejected the private school concept. The mother in that family said she looked at parochial schools. She felt they were too small. She didn't want to keep her kids in an environment where they'd have to just make friends with this small group of kids.
Yep. Okay.
And then she looked at private schools, and she felt they were like country clubs. She really wanted the kids to be exposed to a wider array of people. I mean, you know, in some private school, public school districts, they are so elite that you actually are not going to rub shoulders with people from all walks of life. But she still felt that you know, she would get more diversity in that setting than in a Houston private school.
Wow. We're speaking with Katie McLaughlin, real estate reporter at the Wall Street Journal, about her story entitled Homeowner's Quest for the Best Schools. All right, so we talked about the family went from Houston to Austin. You mentioned New York before. Where you are, Southern California, is this a thing too?
It's definitely a thing. I talked to a family here who moved from Silver Lake, which is a really cool neighborhood. It's got a great music scene. It's really kind of a central LA neighborhood. These people loved it there. They had their kids, I can't remember if their kids were in a charter school or a magnet school, but they had their kids in a special school. But as the kids aged out of that school, they thought, what the heck are we going to do? If we stay here in Silver Lake, we have to pay private school. And when they did the math on it, they also kind of wanted a bigger house. You know, it just didn't work for them. And so they moved to a place that really draws people for the schools, which is La Cañada Flint Ridge. They have a really top school district. And the real estate agents up there say, oh, my gosh, all the people who look for houses here are basically school shopping in addition to house hunting. And it's super competitive to get a house up there.
Wow.
It's almost laughably competitive. Very expensive. And these people, you know, looked at the house. It wasn't in great condition. They bought it that day. They went into escrow that day. They knew they had to jump.
Wall Street Journal reporter Katie McLaughlin. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Kashenka. Coming up this half hour, the most in-demand jobs in America. Also, the NFL's most controversial play. And getting praise from Patriots coach Bill Belichick. You remember when you get it, that story in about 20 minutes. Well, here comes the Super Bowl this Sunday evening, Falcons and Patriots, and with the game come the parties and the snacks, right? Calorie overload if you're not careful. But here's a slightly different approach to take. We're joined by Meg Moranis, fitness trainer and weight loss center manager, also author of Diets Are Fattening, Build Your Healthy Thin Mentality Instead. Meg, what should we do?
Well, back away from a single event like the Super Bowl and kind of take a more global view of eating in general, and that when you are preparing for an event such as a Super Bowl and you know, want to eat healthy, you're afraid you're going to overdo it, you're going to be with a bunch of friends, have chips on the table and all that, what I propose you realize is that nothing is fattening when you're hungry. Everything is fattening when you are not. It makes it a lot easier and a lot more simple to look at what kind of choices you make. And so instead of saying, well, I'm going to make the low-fat chicken or I'm going to have tofu or whatever the heck you're trying to do to avoid calorie overload,
right,
instead of doing that, instead focus on I'm going to eat whatever I want when I'm hungry.
All right, even if it's not the healthiest stuff, say, on Super Bowl Sunday?
That's exactly right. I was a dieter for decades, and I know that feeling of, wow, this isn't healthy. I shouldn't be eating this. I should be eating something else. But that backfires on us because, you know, we are, you know, ingrained to want what we can't have,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
in life in general. So, you know, I remember watching the Super Bowl and being very, quote-unquote, good during the game. But then, you know, later on, I'm still hungry, and I'm in the refrigerator, you know, getting out the stuff I wanted to eat all along anyway, and end up eating more than if I just said to myself, hey, when I'm hungry, if that real chicken wing is what I want, or several of them, or whatever it is, enjoy it. And that's a healthy, thin mentality eating is about releasing all the diet messaging we hear all the time.
Okay.
And instead, reconnecting with hunger.
So instead of, well, it wouldn't be a good idea if you did that Monday through Saturday in addition to Super Bowl Sunday. What you're saying is, once in a while, it's all right to cut loose?
No, I'm saying you have to cut loose.
Oh.
That's a cute way to put it. Yes, because it backfires on you. If you just look around your own life, like what I try to help people do is just notice what's going on here. You know, the amount of people who've become obese since the diet industry roared into our culture is gone up in so many exponential ways that we have to at some point say, wow, maybe this doesn't work. Maybe the diet companies are making a lot of money by telling us that we need them. Do you know anybody who's lost a lot of weight and kept it off? And what is their life like? In my experience, the only people who manage to keep weight off are people who continue to diet. And I think if we said, hey, go on a diet, but you're going to have to diet the rest of your life, we wouldn't do that.
Ooh,
but that is what the reality is. People gain the weight back. Our bodies are programmed to regain weight lost on low-calorie diets.
We're speaking with Meg Moranis, author of a book called Diets Are Fattening, Build Your Healthy Thin Mentality Instead. We're talking about Super Bowl Sunday and perhaps the guilt you might feel about eating snacks. So the right mentality then on an everyday basis would be what? Because you don't want to be eating bad stuff, obviously, like you might see on Super Bowl Sunday. So how do you approach it?
Okay. From my experience, I also worked at Nutrisystem, so I saw this from the inside. Okay, so people have, what you just said is diet mentality thinking, which is so normal and real. And again, I had that for many, many years. So everyone basically walks around with this, well, I shouldn't eat bad stuff and I should do this and I shouldn't do that. And we're led to believe that under our own guidance, we would just eat junk all day long. But the funny thing is, when you finally say, I'm never dieting again, I'm going to trust myself, and even though at first you do not, you build that trust, you realize that, like, where in the past I would sit at a table, and if there was yummy stuff, you know, I would eat some, then I might as well keep eating because I already blew it. It's those kinds of thoughts.
Yeah.
Instead, with a healthy thin mentality, you say, hey, I'm going to eat what I want when I'm hungry. When hunger is gone, I don't deny myself. I simply delay eating more until hunger returns. And I'm happy when I'm hungry because I get to eat.
Thanks, Meg. Meg Moranis. The book is called Diets Are Fattening, Build Your Healthy Thin Mentality Instead. It's 21 minutes in front of the hour on This Weekend. Hey, thanks for being with us. This is an exciting time if you're trying to nail down a career path. A new survey from the folks at CareerCast.com have put together a list of the most in-demand jobs for 2017, including ones in healthcare, tech, and even truck driving. Here's online content editor Kyle Kensing. Kyle, set this up.
So we're looking at jobs that are in great demand right now to such an extent that in some cases there's actually a talent gap. So if you have the skills and the ability, the education to get into one of these lines of work, now's kind of a great time to do so. And it kind of touches on a wide variety of industries too. So there's something for pretty much every skill set or field of discipline that you're in.
Not surprisingly, too, this in-demand jobs list has big growth outlook numbers. Explain some of those.
Absolutely. So one of them, financial advisor, you're looking at 30% growth outlook over the next decade or so, and pay that's pushing about a median salary of $90,000 a year. So you're talking about a lot of high growth outlook positions right now. Home health aid is another one at 38%. That's actually one of the highest growth outlooks of any of the jobs that we track over at CareerCast.com. And physical therapist at 34%. So you're talking a lot of long-term, big growth outlooks, not just temporary demand for positions just in the here and now.
You know what struck me, too? I know that financial advisor, right? Big salary, big growth outlook. I always wonder, is there fear that you'll one day be replaced by, you know, some computer who can seemingly, I don't know, sell faster than you, buy faster than you, or analyze stuff better than you?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's actually something that we have a report coming out in a couple of months now. It's on our schedule, but we're going to be looking at jobs that might be impacted by automation in the future. And that's certainly an interesting point. Right now, that's one that's not projected highly to be impacted by automation. But you never know with the technical advances that are coming out of Silicon Valley. It seems like new innovations every week.
Yeah. We're speaking with Kyle Kensing, online content editor at CareerCast.com. They've got a new survey about the most in-demand jobs in America. Software engineer, boy, for as long as you and I have been talking, that seems to be on these lists. That annual median salary, almost $101,000 and decent growth outlook.
Absolutely. And this is one that, going back to what I mentioned there about Silicon Valley, this is why this is in such high demand. You know, there's always these new innovations, new ways of impacting not just the IT industry, but other industries as well. And software engineering is interesting because it's changing so much. You know, we've talked about in the past with the proliferation of mobile computer usage, you know, with now our phones are essentially laptops to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. So having the ability to translate software to that mobile device is a really in-demand skill set, one that IT companies are still looking for people who are really proficient in.
Yeah, and you mentioned, too, that there are kind of not enough bodies for some of these jobs. Is that reflective in the pay, I guess?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these are a lot of high salaries in most of these jobs, and for that very reason, because you don't necessarily have enough people right now. A good example is data scientist, and that's a new job, one that we've started to track only in the last couple of years at CareerCast. But it's got a 16% growth outlook and pay pushing about $130,000. And that's a field of study right now. A lot of universities don't even have programs for it. So that kind of tells you that this is a burgeoning field right now. Companies are looking for people who are almost self-taught in that kind of data analysis.
Thanks, Kyle. Kyle Kensing, online content editor at CareerCast.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. It is entirely likely that Super Bowl 51 will be decided by a player trying to do something that next year will be a no-no. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
You may see it in the Super Bowl, but you may never see it again in the NFL. It's the league's most controversial play, leaping over the line to try to block an extra point or field goal. Jim Cherusmi of the Wall Street Journal has looked into the strategy and has the story. Jim, first of all, describe what's happening when the defense lines up for a leap.
So, you know, usually the field goal is a routine play in the NFL. The kickers are so good. So teams have figured out the most basic way to block a field goal would be to jump over the line and have a direct pass to the kicker. But it is, of course, dangerous because a player has to leap over gigantic players and try to avoid not landing on them and then block the kick. So it's a play that the league is going to review at the end of the season, and it will probably be banned next season.
Is it technically an illegal play?
No. The rule book says you cannot jump over a player and land on them in an attempt to block the kick, or a player can't lift up a teammate, you know, to basically push him over the line. Those two plays are illegal, but if you have the skills to take a running start, time the snap perfectly, and jump over the line, then it's a legal play.
Okay, there are people that are that athletically gifted. How did this all get started?
Well, in 2013, Pittsburgh Steelers safety Troy Polamalu tried to do it because his team was winning by 1 point and the other team was attempting an extra point, and he decided to do it. He didn't time the snap correctly and basically just hurdled the line before the other team snapped the ball, and it's a play that is now on the blooper reel, but it gave other teams a strategy of, hey, we can actually do this.
And it has been successful since, right?
Yes. It's been attempted about a dozen times. As you said, it requires someone athletic enough to do it. I mean, these guys playing in the NFL, every team has one. The Giants special teams coach told me that this play is in every team's playbook. It's just a matter of using it as a secret weapon or something like that. Every team has a player that can do it, but it's a matter of taking the risk, and it's a risk-reward situation.
Now, you mentioned it's likely going away in the off season. Why is that?
Well, the NFL is big on player safety. You know, concussions are a big issue. This is definitely a dangerous play. You know, having a guy take a running start, jump over the line. If the lineman stands up while a guy is trying to jump over him, you know, a guy can land on his neck and head, and that could be a serious injury. That hasn't happened yet, but I think the NFL is going to look to try to prevent it before something like that would happen.
And is this part of a process where in the off season they review all kinds of things that are going on in the game?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the coaches after this field goal leap, they tied a game because of the field goal leap, said it's the dangerous, most dangerous play in football. And I think the league takes notes about that and teams register complaints. And then after the season, they review situations where they might, you know, consider changing the rule on certain things. And this is going to be one of them that is under review.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Jim Cherusmi. It's 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. The New England Patriots, as you know, are an accomplished group. It's hard for me to admit as a Jets fan. Almost every player in the locker room for New England has a Super Bowl ring. A good chunk have made Pro Bowls and won awards. But the Wall Street Journal says inside the famous hallways of Foxborough, there's an accomplishment they cherish, one so rare they can recall the circumstances with precision. The time Bill Belichick told them they were doing a good job. For defensive end Rob Ninkovich, as he says, it was Jacksonville 2009. He made a bunch of plays against the Jaguars that coach liked that day. He's been with New England 8 seasons. Special teamer Matthew Slater says it was the 2014 season versus Oakland, when he had a handful of tackles on punt returns, including one in which returner T.J. Carey lost a yard. Belichick has become famous for his oft-repeated saying, "Do your job." For punter Ray Allen, it was his rookie season, the Denver game. In a win over the Broncos, he had an overtime 51-yard punt in bad weather. Coach liked that one. Belichick does it for groups of players, but generally not individuals. Like you might say, okay, good job offense, good job defense. Players say holding back, good job, for special occasions is a strategy that works. Falcons win it 24-20 over the Patriots Sunday night, Super Bowl 51. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.